Welcome to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast series. Open House Melbourne acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was recorded. This podcast series explores themes or issues that act as catalysts for creative design thinking and clever design solutions. Each episode features a designer or creative in conversation with a client or field expert to unpack the topic through the lens of design and the built environment. This podcast was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. I'm your host, Tanya Davidge, and in this episode, we're looking at flood as a catalyst for planning and design. In the midst of a climate crisis, where we're seeing increasing extreme weather events, how can we plan and design for flood? Is it simply a matter of barricading our buildings against the flooding waters, or can we work with the ebbs and flows of our water ecosystem to design in a more responsive way? Today we're speaking with planner Jane Keddie from Hanson Partnership and architect James Davidson from JDA & Co. to discuss how planning and design can work with the weather and environmental flows to mitigate risk and rethink our relationship to water. Jane, you're a planner. Can you tell us about the type of work that you do at Hanson?
Thanks, Tanya. I think one of the important things about planning is that it's got a few different disciplines. So I work in the strategic planning space. So I look at the kind of long-term place-based plans and policy that we need in place to make sure that we get the kind of urban environments that we want to. So a significant amount of that work for me is around the climate change space. And so that obviously includes flooding. And most of the work I do is generally for state or local government.
Ah, oh, fantastic. And James, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you do?
Sure. So I'm an architect based in Brisbane, and we've been doing work in the flood resilience space since the floods in 2011. It's when we really kind of kicked off. I grew up in Rockhampton, where it's sort of regularly flood, so it wasn't sort of something that I was necessarily afraid of when I first started, but we've certainly developed a bit of a niche in this particular area. So the purpose of the work we try and do is to create buildings that could easily just be washed out and allow people to get back and recover from an event as quickly as possible. So we're currently working in residential, some commercial, and then quite a lot of government work as well. So yeah.
I think up in Queensland, you'd be having a lot more, I suppose, a lot more experience with floods than we've got down here in Victoria.
Yeah. It seems like every year there's something goes on up here, whether it's in the north of the state or in the southeast or in the central west. I think that unfortunately we're uniquely placed to become kind of experts in this area. I've done quite a bit of work in Victoria, and I have a bit of an understanding about what goes on down there. And it seems that you've got a lot more sort of broader, you know, lower level flooding than what we do up here in Queensland.
But I feel like we're becoming much more cognizant around the way that climate change is affecting us down here in Victoria. I was wondering, Jane, maybe you could speak a little bit to what's happening in Victoria and where we're at.
Sure. I think you're right. There's certainly been a shift maybe in recent years to recognise that climate change is really starting to play out in terms of the hazards that everyone's been telling us are coming, and flood obviously being primarily amongst that. And there's certainly a lot more interest and awareness, I think, in different pockets about the impacts that can have, and the need for us to perhaps start thinking a little bit differently about how we respond to that hazard.
So how is flooding affecting Melbourne at the moment? Like, what's our context? What is our future as well?
I think, as James said, you know, we're really just starting to see some of the impacts playing out. In Melbourne's context, we probably don't have as many extreme flood events as you might see in Queensland, but we do get them. And obviously the recent floods that impacted areas in central Melbourne were part of that, but we're also seeing impacts across broader regional areas in terms of riverine flooding, and that will continue. What we'll see under climate change is obviously more intense bursts of rainfall, and that has really significant impacts in terms of the ability for our kind of urban environment to cope with those volumes of water. And that's where design becomes really important in terms of the resilience of our cities to those kind of impacts. The other area Melbourne will be significantly impacted by is sea level rise. And we really haven't turned our minds to that in Melbourne. But if you think about Melbourne, you know, we are built around a bay, and many of those areas are low-lying areas that would have been kind of marshes and wetlands that were kind of adjoining that bay originally. And those areas then become really vulnerable to sea level rise. And I think University of Melbourne, I think, did some work looking at properties in the city of Port Phillip. And I think it was something like a third of all properties in the city of Port Phillip would be inundated under just 0.5 metres of sea level rise, which is well below what we're anticipating will play out. So there's really significant numbers of properties and really significant urban areas in Melbourne that are going to be impacted either by sea level rise and the storm surge associated with that. That's before we even start talking about erosion as well. There's also areas that will be impacted by riverine flooding. But then there's also the impacts and the flooding that's associated with what we call overland flows. So where you have a drainage system that can't cope with the volumes of water that might happen in a kind of, a really intense downpour, and that then creates flooding overland as well.
Ah, so there's also an infrastructural problem that we're addressing. I'm down in Port Phillip, so I'm in a flood zone, so I'm feeling the pain a little bit. And it's interesting to hear, I think, about the character of and quality of Melbourne and Victoria's flooding. It's very different in Queensland, isn't it, James? What's the character of potential flooding in Queensland?
I think the Great Dividing Range has a big part to play in all of this for us, right? Like, it stretches all the way from, you know, New South Wales. I think it probably even goes all the way down into Victoria. But in a way, all the way through to Cairns and then stops just shy of Cape York, essentially. And a lot of our cities are all on the eastern seaboard, east of that. But what that means is that we've got this sort of topography that we have to deal with, whereas Melbourne, what I saw down there is it's generally very flat. And that's, you know, similar to what Jane is saying, like, you know, the sea level rise is going to become a bigger issue. So I see that Victoria is more sort of could follow the Dutch kind of model where you try and keep the water out as much as you can. Whereas up here in Queensland, it's very difficult to deal with. Like, we're dealing with 6-7 meters of depth of water at times, running at about 4 to 12 meters a second, and those sorts of flood events are hitting properties. They're like inland tsunamis, but weirdly, people still don't seem to want to move. And some will. Like, we're working in the Northern Rivers at the moment, and there's a big buyback program that we're sort of slightly attached to, and the Queensland current Resene Homes fund program that we're actually working on as well. I think we're working in 37 LGAs across the southeast, and it's an interesting one. That the kind of like, even for overland flow, we're getting a meter and a half of water in certain instances. Creek, we're getting 2 to 3 meters of depth in some areas, and then riverine, it's even more. So we approach things with a bit of an open mind, because nothing ever sort of seems to surprise us anymore. It's just, but the conversation has definitely shifted between 2011 and now. I think the more events that we've had, when we first started this work, it was a bit of a hard sell, the whole flood resilience idea, because even though we'd flooded, going into people's homes and saying, hey, we're going to retrofit your home for the next flood event, it was like, oh no, that was just a one-off, that one, and it was a dam operator's fault, and it'll never happen again, right? And And that became the kind of narrative for about a decade. And then 2022 happened. And I think that's changed the whole conversation. It's a lot easier now. And I feel that there's a momentum building and that's probably part of the reason we're even talking now. It just seems more front and center in terms of a lot of people's minds in government as well, which that's the change I've seen.
I think one of the really interesting things and one of the differences that you can see there is that in Melbourne we've got what's likely to be, and across the state, larger, but particularly Melbourne, we've got larger numbers of properties that are likely to be affected because it's
definitely
it's much flatter. So we've got larger numbers that are probably going to be less significantly impacted. So that to me is what makes the conversation around what the design response is much more interesting. So for instance, in Queensland, Northern Rivers, there's a really important conversation that goes on around buybacks because some of those areas are just the hazard is so significant that it's almost impossible to mitigate it. In the Victorian context, in the Melbourne context, there's a lot more really exciting opportunities to think about how we respond to that hazard through design responses.
I totally agree. When we did the work for Melbourne Water years ago, I think there was something like 270,000 homes that were at risk of a sort of a 1% AEP flood event, which is around about a metre, or I can't really remember the actual figures, but it seemed to me like it was actually a doable, workable design solution that could be kind of thought about across the city. And so whereas it is a lot harder up here talking to people when they've literally had 7 metres of water go through their property, you know.
What's interesting to me is that we're talking about resilience, right? And what the conversation or how the conversation is shifting, it feels a little bit like we're asking people to understand what flood impacts might occur, like what the impact of flooding might be in their local areas, and to think about how we might be able to live with that and work with that. So this idea of resilience implies a bit more flexibility. I was wondering if you could both speak a little bit to this idea of flexibility and resilience.
Can I just track back in terms of people being actually aware of the impact of flooding and the fact that they're impacted? Because one of the real challenges that we have here in Victoria is that there's not a lot of transparency around which areas are impacted by flooding and also how those different types of flooding interact. We kind of look at kind of different types of flooding, via different studies. We use different overlays, et cetera, in the planning sense. So one of the challenges that we have here is that we don't actually have up-to-date flood modelling in a lot of our areas. We don't, for instance, you know, we know that there's large swathes of metropolitan Melbourne that will be significantly impacted by sea level rise. We currently don't have any overlays in our planning schemes that actually reflect that. And what that means is that there's not a permit trigger to say when you're designing a new development in these areas, you need to think about the flood risk. And there's also not transparency for community members and people out there that their properties may be subject to flood risk, and they might want to think about resilience when they're kind of designing their house or the like. So there's certainly a long way to go here, even just in getting that transparency and getting that consistency and understanding the flood risk that we have and the hazards. You know, at the moment, even the sea level rise benchmark that we're using hasn't been reviewed for a very long time since before the latest IPCC report. So I think in Victoria, the first step is really around getting that modelling done and getting that consistency, making sure that it's reflected in our controls so that we can then have a conversation around what does the response to that look like. Yeah. At the moment, we're still having a conversation around which areas are subject to flooding. And you'll see there's been, you know, numerous examples recently where residents are like, what do you mean my property's subject to flooding? Because there's not that transparency. And I don't think we can expect to have a productive and I guess, forward-looking conversation around what those design responses look when we don't have that awareness mm-hmm. of where those areas are.
And James, are you seeing, I mean, with Queensland being much more used to flooding events, I'd assume that the policy levels and people's understanding of flood is a little bit more present. What's resilience like in Queensland?
Yeah, I think as Jane, you were talking, I was thinking to myself, we were where you guys are after 2011 and probably all the way through to close to 2022, really. We were doing a lot of work in, like, the interesting thing about what you just mentioned is, like, if I'm thinking about the value of what we're talking about in this podcast, for instance, the call that I would say is to reflect what Jane just said, which is, I do believe that these things need to be done before an event happens, because we've been running, you know, $740 million program across a whole bunch of different LGAs that, and then in New South Wales, it's a similar scale, but the Northern Rivers weren't prepared as much as, say, Queensland was with flood modelling. So we've got sort of, it's a complex situation where you're, a lot of the time after an event, you feel like you're building the plane as you're flying it. And it makes everything very complicated. Whereas in the work that we've done in Southeast Queensland, a lot of the smaller LGAs didn't have their flood modelling really worked out, but the larger ones did, and that really helped. We were able to kind of, as soon as the event happened, we were able to sort of put a system in place when the government announced money for recovery and resilience and retrofitting and raising, and because that's the sort of thing that happens after these events now. We were able to then use that really well, really good data, whereas a lot of the smaller LGAs might have had the data, but we're sort of sitting on it because it becomes a big problem when politically for people to release data too soon. Because even for us, right, I mean, there's no better time to release data than after an event happens. I've seen that time and time again. I have thought to myself it would have been better to have released the data prior to the event, but I've seen that also. And the issue with that is that you get people coming out and saying, what do you mean I'm in a flood zone? I've never seen it flood. I've lived here 60 years and it's never flooded. But I can tell you, we've worked with people like that where we've gone in prior to the 2022 floods as part of the Brisbane City Council program we were working on. We retrofitted their home. It was a really tough sell. A lot of older people saying, mate, never flooded here, never flooded here. Like, this is called Wavell Heights. What do you mean? What do you reckon? That's why it's got heights in the name. It's never going to flood. I've been here 50 years. And then literally within a year of us doing the works, weirdly, it flooded and badly. And people were saying, oh, my God, like, you were right. And we're like, well, yeah, because it's the interesting thing about water is that it follows topography. So bushfires, different story. And you guys down in Victoria are fully well aware of that stuff, right? But the interesting thing about flooding is you can predict where it's going to go. And then you can actually work out in terms of the modelling at what sort of likelihood, and then you can look at the consequence of that. And so, you know, a lot of the work that we did pre-2022 was a hard sell, but it was vindicated when people were literally back in their homes within a couple of days and cleaned up and helping their neighbours recover. So I think if I was, you know, making the decisions down in Victoria, I'd be building off the work that everybody's doing up here and saying, okay, and one of those critical things is awareness raising and getting the information out to people, because if they're surprised, they can't recover as well. And that's something that is critical, is if there's a greater awareness, then the recovery response will be a lot quicker and better. Whereas if people didn't even know they're in a flood zone and then they flood, they don't know what to do. So, you know, at least they have to get them thinking about it is a good thing, and you need to give them the information. So, yeah.
So we've got, we need more up-to-date modelling. We need to raise the awareness of the issues and who and how we're impacted within the community. What are the other challenges that we're seeing in our systems, Jane?
I think one of the ones that builds on to that issue of having the controls in place and having that transparency is in Victoria, it's something that is required of local governments, and we've got 79 different local governments. So rather than it being maybe I'll talk to the bushfire, because James, you mentioned bushfire, for instance, in Victoria, that issue of kind of responding after an event. We had a bushfire that was really significant. We had a Royal Commission, and then the state took the lead. They put in place what's called a bushfire management overlay. The state applies that based on science. Every 5 years or so, they update it. It's not subject to, you know, the whims of 79 different local governments or communities.
Because obviously water doesn't stop at your local government boundary.
That's a really important issue, because and that's one of the reasons why, you know, I believe strongly it's something that the state government does need to lead, because what happens is you get, you know, you're increasing significantly the chances of things like maladaptation, because what you get is you get different areas having different responses. We get inconsistent responses, which is confusing to the community. And we also get mitigation actions that maybe don't necessarily think about the kind of the impacts across different areas. And we've seen examples of that probably in Melbourne as well, which is why you really want to be looking at it holistically, because flooding doesn't recognise municipal boundaries. So it seems odd that we're using municipal boundaries as the kind of the implementation tool, if you like. Mm.
So one of our challenges here in Victoria is to look at this as more holistically, like look at the ecology of the system and how different parts interact.
If we want to be, you know, genuinely looking at how we can evolve our city and our state into a more resilient place, then, yeah, certainly I don't think it's something that we can do at local government scale. It needs to be something that's very much led by the state government. And then the kind of the nuanced responses might be developed by local governments with their communities, have those conversations about, well, those hazards are here. What's our response going to be? What are we looking at? Because there's a whole lot that needs to be unpacked in terms of that conversation with the community as well.
Absolutely. And what are some of the challenges that you're looking at further north, James?
It's an interesting one. Obviously, we've got a very different building typology up this way. So, I should say that we've got a lot of brick veneer slab on ground homes too. Interestingly, I've seen some quite good innovation in that space in lower level flooding areas. But part of the problem we've got is, how high is too high? And I mean, you know, we've got a sort of a general height restriction across the city and, well, across the state really, of about 9.5 meters. But that means we've been putting raises through the program that are about 6.5 meters out of the ground. And now we're getting situations where, you know, grandma can no longer come and visit the family after they've raised the house, because she can't literally walk up the stairs. But in the system that we currently have, like, what other alternative do people have? The buybacks are fraught. They're necessary, but they're fraught, because if you've got a housing crisis and you don't have enough land available, then where do people go? So, well, I agree with that approach, and I've seen very good outcomes from it. You can't just do that for everybody. And then the next question is, well, if you can raise the house, how high? And we're seeing some really weird streetscapes that end up sort of, and then you think, well, if everybody's living like 7 meters in the air, how easy is it then to interact with your neighbor? And what are you going to do? You come home and carry the groceries and get upstairs, and then you just lock yourself in. And so we're essentially living in tree houses almost. And so, you know, so it's a bit, I think that's the kind of one of our biggest challenges moving forward, is how do we maintain beautiful communities that sort of are well connected, yet at the same time deal with extreme sort of depths of flooding.
Yeah.
And the other problem that we've had, And I do think that this is something to consider in Victoria as well, is we've had the 1% AEP here in Brisbane for riverine flooding raised 4 times in, like, I think it's since 2016.
So what's an AEP?
So annual exceedance probability. So it's the old, when people used to talk about 1 in 100, we no longer talk about, we've learnt that when you say something like, oh, well, that's a 1 in 100 year flood, mums and dads who don't know anything think, oh, well, that's going to take another 100 years to come around again. Whereas actually it's a 1% per annum chance of having a major flood. And so we prefer to talk in percentages these days because if you talk in like a 1 in 500 year flood, and I've been in conversations with people out in central west of New South Wales where they go, but Australia wasn't even settled 500 years ago. So how do we even know it was a 1 in 500 year flood? You know, that kind of thing. Whereas the percentages based system works better from a communication point of view. But my point, I suppose, is that with every major event, the modelling changes. And that's the thing that we need to make sure that everybody's aware of, is just because at this point it's a particular line and it's a height, doesn't mean it's going to stay there like that forever. It will change. And with every event, they update the models. And typically that 1%, that 1 in 100 year level keeps going up. So then you have to raise a house even more and, you know, those things.
A few things that it's really interesting to talk about in terms of what James has just raised. I mean, as a planner, one of the things we look at is, you know, how we create great urban environments, and that tension between our flood response and our response, you know, particularly, for instance, in areas like what we call activity centres, so kind of places where you want street front activation and people to be kind of accessing cafes or shops, etc., the impacts in terms of the design response to that kind of floor level rise. Think about lots of Melbourne's heritage areas as subject to significant flooding. We have planning controls that have, you know, maximum height limits. There's a whole series of kind of interacting issues in terms of what that design response is. There's some really interesting conversations around that. But what we have at the moment in Victoria is what I would say is a really static response to flood and to how we manage that through our planning system. And it becomes a real issue both in terms of getting good design outcomes, but it also becomes a real issue in terms of what James is talking about in terms of the 1% AEP is the flood risk at a certain point in time based on a certain modelling set, based on a certain benchmark that's been established. But it doesn't mean that they're the only areas that are going to flood. It doesn't mean that that's going to be the maximum flood level. So we have things called maximum probable flood levels, which are probably well above what the 1% AEP is. But we've kind of chosen, a kind of reasonable point at which to kind of do our mapping. But the reality is that there's different impacts that often go well beyond that. And those impacts, you know, if you look at what's going on in terms of our response to climate change and our, you know, how we're tracking to meet the Paris Agreement, et cetera, it's significantly likely that you know, we're heading towards maybe more significant impacts than we've been planning for. And so when we have a system that picks, you know, one certain point in time and goes, right, well, that's what we're designing everything to, I would suggest that's probably not as resilient as a response that, for instance, a lot of the work that James does up in Queensland is around, you know, flood resilience in terms of actually designing, you know, lower levels of buildings to actually be much more resilient so that they can flood. And it doesn't matter if it's at, you know, 30 centimetres or 70 centimetres, because the whole kind of building has been designed to think about flooding, as opposed to we're just going to raise our floor level to this particular point.
So, for example, where I am, I'm down in Elwood. I'm not far from the canal. I'm in SB01, which
one
is
of
the special buildings overlay, which is, so we're prone to flooding. If I would like to build a new house or add on to the back, I have to build my floors currently a metre above what they are, and my house did almost flood in 2011. So it was lapping at our front door. But for me as an architect, the relation to the street, and I love, you know, I love where I live. Like, it's fantastic. It's great. We're close to everything. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful area. I would be happy with perhaps part of my house flooding if I could move things to other parts of my house which were taller. And so I think there is this really interesting conversation to be had around what's acceptable. And I know that James has been working on some schools up in Queensland that actually are looking at different solutions to simply raising the floor level. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about them.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, what we've learnt over time of doing this work is that the use, it, obviously certain uses are kind of okay to put in a flood zone. Like, that's something that where I always kind of rub up in certain tension with planners, because typically the planning scheme's all about a line, as Jane was saying, and then keeping everything above that line. Whereas what we've found over time is if you could detail the construction systems well enough, obviously I don't agree with putting habitable spaces where people are sleeping in, you know, in the path of risk, but certainly having more flexibility around the kind of activities that could be permissible in sort of a floodable area. And that's something that we're doing with the schools at the moment. And actually, just in the last few days, the Victorian Department of Education reached out to us as well because they heard about the stuff we're doing up here. So facilitating a bit of a sharing arrangement going on. But for instance, one school we're working on, you know, lost millions of dollars of musical equipment when they knew they were in a flood zone. And it's like, well, come on, guys, don't put the music space downstairs. Like, but you could put, you know, the gym, which survived, and they just washed the gym equipment out. And the other critical thing with all of this is being able to get in and clean up as quickly as possible. One of our big bugbears with insurers is that they a lot of the time prevent people from getting in until their assessors have been through. And in an event, once you've had a big scale event, it takes time for that organization to occur, i.e. getting people out to assess. And a lot of damage is actually done post an event by just sitting around in muddy, like in a muddy situation with, you know, sort of mold starting to grow and things like that. So it's a part of all that. It's not just about the building fabric. It's also about the management of the post-event situation. And that's something that we're working on at the moment with the Queensland government is, and in the schools context, but also in the resilient homes context, is what is the actual approach, like what is the response? And I think that it sort of talks to the two critical things, which are buildings and people. And if you can design your buildings well enough to defend against an event, you know, like bushfire, you end up with those Ned Kelly looking houses, you know, wrapped in steel and whatever. And whereas with flooding, the approach we've taken is to allow the water to come in and out. We don't try and keep the water out, because we've had bad situations occur when we've done that. And so critically, it's about how do you respond. And I think a little bit more nuanced is what we need in the planning scheme or planning system across the country, really.
I think one of the interesting things that Queensland does is that they model, in some areas, they model the different types of floods. So not just the 1%, but also the 0.5% or the 2%, the maximum probable flood level. They model all of those things so that they've got an understanding of the different extent of impact for different types of flood events. And then they cross-reference that with different uses and different things that might occur on the land. So you get this kind of matrix of actually fitting the right controls for the right type of use to the right type of flood. Because some, you know, some uses you might want to keep out of any areas that are subject to flooding. Others, as James says, might be fine if you design them in a particular way and you manage them in a particular way, and you've got that awareness and education around how you need to actually live with that flood risk.
I've got a good example of exactly what you just talked about there, Jane. One of the schools that we're currently helping, They've got their OSH, you know, the after school care and before school care centre, and under the local planning scheme, that should typically be about 7 metres out of the ground. And there's been a question about, well, but if we don't do that, then the kids are going to be at risk. But the interesting thing is, when we actually looked at the data, they're already above the 1% overland flow level, whereas they're well and truly below the 1% riverine. Obviously, the 1% riverine is the thing that determines the planning or planning's calling. But that's 7 meters in the air, whereas the 1% for overland flow is around a meter above the ground level. And so the recommendation back is to say, well, realistically, we do get quite a lot of time around and quite a lot of notice about a riverine event. The overland flow, we don't get much notice. It's in a big downpour and it comes and goes quickly. But for example, it's much better to have kids close to the ground where they can just run out onto the oval rather than having them 7 meters in the air and having to come down a lift. And so there's the schools at the moment, just I think they're going to lean towards keeping the OSH where it currently is, because in a way they can then work out a management process around these larger overland flow events. And so that's sort of the matrix that you're talking about, is to consider it on its, well, what is it actually doing and what is it meant to do and what's going to be the impact of having children 7 meters in the air? So, you know.
So basically what you're saying is that the events that you don't get as much warning for, the kids can already just move upstairs so they'll be safe. And the events that you get more warning for, well, maybe the kids will have time to move away.
And they're probably not going to even be there in the first place.
So that you don't have to design for something that will be prohibitive most of the time to them running out into the oval. That's a really fantastic and interesting response, I think.
Mm. And it can happen across multiple uses. Like, you could take that same kind of thought process and to anything, in a way, you know. And
Well, I mean, one of the really interesting things as well in terms of how we design to live with flooding, which I think we have to do. The reality is that we're going to see more and more flooding under climate change. So we really do need to start thinking about how we're going to live with it and how we're going to work with it. And one of the challenges that we have as well, I think, is that we're very focused on kind of lot scale responses. So we look at individual sites and we look at what their response needs to be to respond to that hazard. But actually we do need to think a little bit broader than that, and not just across local government areas, but, you know, across the whole kind of city ecosystem around what we need to change in terms of our streets, in terms of our parks, in terms of all of the things that can contribute to that resilience to flooding. So, you know, we have situations where thinking about how we design our streets can help with some of those access issues that you're talking about, where you've got that interface between a lot scale response, which is, you know, creating a real disconnection between the activity that's occurring in the building and the street. There's some really interesting opportunities if we start looking at kind of streetscape, at neighbourhood scale, at city scale, in terms of how we actually respond to these issues. And things like that coastal sea level rise, we have to look at that as a kind of a whole city response, because we can't incrementally mitigate against those impacts, you know, neighbourhood by neighbourhood. We really need to think about how all parts of the system are going to work together.
Mm-hmm. And are there international examples we can look to? I mean, the Netherlands has been dealing with water inundation for a very long time. You know, like, what do they do there? Would that work in our context?
I think they're a great, because they're a delta as well. Like, Brisbane's a bit of a reverse delta. You know, we've got a lot of tributaries feeding into one big river, and then it hits Moreton Bay. Whereas you guys are sort of more of a I think you guys are actually a Delta system. And so I do believe that the Dutch would be a very good reference. And there's things like, you know, Rotterdam, there's places like Rotterdam that are 6 meters below sea level, and they're still able to kind of get their drainage systems to work somehow, which boggles my mind. But yeah, I think in a way, one of the lessons I've learned from the Dutch is actually they always look for the opportunities. That's what Jane just mentioned as well, is that there it's not like this is woe is me kind of existence from here on. It's actually, what are the kind of interesting sort of urban environments that we can create? And they're, you know, the Dutch have been doing it for 1,000 years. They started small, obviously, and they've been holding and managing water across the country for a long time. And interestingly, their water boards are more powerful than their politicians a lot of the time, because without their water boards, they wouldn't be surviving. Whereas if you give too many people too much to say in the matter, then they might not actually be able to make a decision a lot of the time. And so, you know, I think it's something that one of the complications in Melbourne or in Victoria is you do have so many small little councils that make their own rules. And that just, to me, it seems so against the idea of creating a cohesive kind of plan for the city or for the state generally. So,
well, I mean, they theoretically operate under state government guidelines, but the realities are that when you have, you know, locally elected representatives, they're making decisions that they see as in the best interests of their local community.
That's right. That's
now,
right.
The best interests of their local community might not be the best interests of the whole of the city.
Yeah.
So that's where that issue of state leadership really, really comes into it. Those opportunities, I think, are really, really fantastic to start thinking about, because we have, you know, we have a situation where there does tend to be a very much a negative lens put on flooding and flood hazard. The reality is it's something we're going to need to live with. Whether we've got a planning overlay or the modelling's been done or not doesn't change the fact that places are going to flood. You know, the flood doesn't go away just because someone hasn't put an overlay in the planning scheme. The flood is still there. The flood hazard still remains. What the overlay lets us do is have some awareness of that and provide a trigger so that we can actually think about what the design response needs to be. But that's still going to exist. We're still going to need to live with it. And those examples, and I think not just the Netherlands, but also places, quite a lot of the Scandinavian countries as well, do really good work in terms of, you know, dealing with intense rainfall events, etc. And it really comes down to a citywide strategy and a citywide approach. And they think about flooding in terms of their streetscape designs, their park designs. You know, there's so many potential benefits when we think about designing with water and working with water. You know, you think about things like the biodiversity benefits that we can have when we start kind of leaving space for water. You know, permeability is a really important part. So we're not kind of concreting over everything in our urban areas. We're opening up more natural land, if you like, that has massive implications for biodiversity. Things like urban cooling, you know, another one of the impacts we're going to feel is kind of climate change. If we work with water, water's really great at cooling down our city. So, you know, there's a whole series of really positive benefits that we can actually tap into if we really start thinking seriously about what our design response could look like.
Yeah, and I think that's a fantastic point that you made before, because we often, about the city changing essentially, like, and what we, you know, the challenges that we actually will have to live with. I mean, we often think of the city as a really static thing. It's bricks and mortar. It doesn't move. It doesn't change. But we actually know that cities respond to different challenges and different, you know, different ways of life, different ways of work, all of the different things, like our cities respond. And so if we can actually work with water, there are potentially some fantastic opportunities. What do you see the design opportunities being, James?
I think a lot greater sort of open public space. Something that we've been involved with in Brisbane around the Kurilpa plan that the council's kind of working on is what do you do with public space? And one of the interesting things that, because they are starting to recognise the fact that if you build resiliently at the ground plane, then you can actually, you don't have to kind of fill a metre or two to get above a particular level and then have people walking upstairs to, which are then they're divorced from the street and it just affects everything. Whereas the plans that are currently happening is, that we've been involved with, is a lot more recognition. And to be honest, I'm quite excited about the quality of the ground plane that we're going to be seeing, because generally it means that the more sort of habitable buildings or the habitable levels of the buildings are higher, but it then means that there's a lot more open space underneath them. And, you know, like the kind of old modernist buildings that you sort of, interestingly, I met Herman Hertzberger while I was over in the Netherlands on my Churchill Fellowship, and he actually said to me that he started his love affair with the modernist movement out of the 1950s floods that occurred in the Netherlands. So the last time they had major floods, and that's why he was interested in putting a lot of his buildings on pilotis and things like that, and columns. And that's what I'm starting to see here in Brisbane is, you know, we were talking with the council about big fig trees sitting underneath a building. And so in a way, the public can take back the ground plane, and it's not just have, you know, access to basement car parks and things like that take up the majority of the street frontage from the building. And, you know, all sorts of, I think, just generally cool things could actually happen. So, you know, I'm sort of hoping that, and then you get this situation which Jane mentioned before about heritage. You can't just raise a heritage building. So what do? You fill everything else around it and then leave this thing. I think heritage and flooding are complementary as well, where, you know, you don't have to just demolish stuff and fill and then build on top again kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, in a Melbourne context, it's, if you talk about public space and how those work in terms of flood resilient design, you know, one of the real challenges that we're going to have here is that, you know, again, we're in Melbourne, we're based around a bay, we're going to have coastal erosion as well as sea level rise, and those things are all going to over time eat into some of our really valued public space. You think about all our kind of beachfront reserves, etc. They're really important part of Melbourne and the kind of the public domain of Melbourne. We need to start thinking about, you know, how those are going to kind of be resilient, and whether we need kind of more areas of open space to kind of offset the areas that we're going to lose. There's a really important conversation that we need to have as a community about that as well.
I'm just seeing it personally from a personal perspective as the beach coming closer to my house, and in 50 years' time, I'll have beachfront property. It'll be fantastic, and I'll be sorted. It'll be great. One of the things I think that I'd like to touch on as well is this idea of, I suppose we're speaking a lot at the moment, we're really thinking quite deeply in the built environment about designing with water, designing with country. And I think this is a really beautiful thing, and it sounds to me a little bit like some of the things that I'm hearing from you both is actually working with the environment and working with country. I wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
I mean, I think there's clear correlations between a response that recognises the kind of the ecosystem and the natural environment and gives that natural environment space to be as it should be and as it was before we, you know, built all of our houses. And those principles of kind of letting the land have space and letting it play out as it would, as much as we can within obviously a highly developed environment. But that those principles of caring for country are deeply kind of enmeshed with the idea of actually kind of giving the land space to kind of do what it does. You know, and there's obviously improvements to biodiversity and the like that you can get through flood resilient design responses are all, you know, positive in terms of those concepts as well.
Yeah, it's about working with the natural elements, isn't it, and sort of not against them a lot of the time. And, you know, I don't want to be sort of a typical virtue signalling architect, but, you know, it is something that's on my mind a lot, where all you have to do is a lot of the time listen to country and what it's telling us. And a lot, and we've, you know, had generations of ignoring it, thinking that we knew better and we could do better. And whereas I think going forward, it'd be wonderful to have, you know, a whole professional, you know, industry in this area where we're literally allowing and we're working with the elements and instead of against them. So, you know, I think that will happen. I think we have no other choice. What's the alternative? To continue to ignore it?
Like, I would hope that is an inevitable part of where we're going, you know, to deal with the challenge of climate change, which is a really, really significant challenge to particularly our urban environments. I'm not sure, you know, we've quite got our heads around the kind of the scale of the challenge that will be over the coming decades. But it really does offer up so many opportunities if you start thinking about things in terms of, you know, dynamic systems that work with the natural environment rather than us kind of, you know, building flood walls or, you know, designing kind of, you know, buildings that are the finished floor levels 2.5 metres above the ground. You know, there's so many opportunities there if we kind of shift to that more dynamic way of thinking about how we're going to respond to and live with flood. It's really exciting, and hopefully we see it play out over the next little while as well.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. We've come to the end of our conversation today. Unfortunately, we could go on, I feel like, for much, much longer. It's been a really insightful and fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank James and Jane for joining me here today as part of the Flood as Catalyst podcast episode. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast. Open House Melbourne delivers Australia's largest architecture and built environment festival and year-round programming that connects people to place and builds public understanding of good design, inspiring people to explore, celebrate and care for their cities, suburbs and regions. Open House Melbourne's Catalyst podcast series was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. This series is recorded at The Push in Collingwood Yard, a youth music organisation and charity with the purpose of giving every young person the opportunity to participate and thrive in Australian music. Find out more about The Push at thepush.com.au.